My thanks to former Governor Bob Miller in Nevada, who joined us to talk about Son of a Gambling Man, his new book. If you're at all interested in the history of Las Vegas, it's a pretty entertaining read. But we are shifting gears now. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program tonight, I don't think I've had a bigger reaction to a topic or a guest than what's coming up next. Missing 411 is is the general title of now what is three-volume set, investigatory work by former cop Dave Politis, and it has created quite an outpouring of reaction from you coast-to-coast listeners, has sold a lot of copies. David is back now with volume three that expands his investigation into these weird disappearances beyond the borders of the United States. We take our break and come right back with Dave Politis here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Dave Politis holds 2 degrees from the University of San Francisco, has a professional background, including 20 years in law enforcement and senior executive positions in the technology sector. If you've been listening to the show for a while, you know of his interest in Bigfoot. He's one of the founders of the North America Bigfoot Search, has written two of what I consider to be the most credible books about the search for truth about Bigfoot. And that search led him to something entirely different, a different kind of mystery that is represented in now 3 volumes of his book, Missing 411, this latest one, North America Cases and Beyond. Dave, great to have you back on the show.
Hey, George, thanks for having me.
I don't want to dwell too much because I want to talk primarily about your book, but we have to talk about Bigfoot and the DNA study. I should remind our listeners that you were one of the instigators of this. You helped collect the samples. You went out and looked for somebody to conduct the DNA search. You and your partners settled on Melba Ketchum. Talk to me in general reaction about the study results and perhaps more importantly, the reaction of the Bigfoot community to the results, because it's been all over the map, but in particular, it's been pretty harsh.
You know, it's mixed bag, just like you said. I think that the people that are making derogatory comments, I would say probably 90% of them haven't read the study, and that's unfortunate. The study is sound. We got over 100 different samples. We were the group that brought in other groups to help us bring samples in from throughout North America. We had nuclear DNA and mitochondrial DNA that was accumulated. We had 3 different labs do the testing. It wasn't one lab. We had several PhDs write the paper. It wasn't one. We've had some comments from some people in the Bigfoot world that I was shocked that they would say something like they did. And I think that we've ruffled some feathers of many, many old-timers out there because they've lived in a world where Bigfoot was an ape. And for the people who don't understand this, there's really just 2 factions. You either believe it's a human-based creature or it's an ape or a gorilla. And if you look at all of the older researchers that have been around 40, 50 years, the centerpiece of their books is apes in the North or apes in North America, et cetera, et cetera. And just to bring some reality to this, there's never been any ape or gorilla bones, never any ape or gorilla hair ever found any time anywhere in North America in the wild. If you talk to any Native American group or First Nations group in Canada, they all believe Bigfoot, Sasquatch is a human. Every tribe states it's a human. Many tribes in the Pacific Northwest that I've written about in the past say that they trade with them, that they communicate with them. This was written in newspapers in the Oregonian way back in the 20s and the 30s. Now, why these people seem to ignore all these facts, I have no idea. And when we first got into this realm of research, we didn't have a dog in the fight. We could have went any which direction. It was just to get to the truth. And part of that truth is accumulating DNA and having labs test it. Well, I don't believe that they like the result. And unfortunately, many of the journals in the world seem to be less than honest. And what I mean by that is that the PhDs that wrote this paper, scientific white paper, submitted it. I was privy to the response from some of these journals. The questions that came back from them were embarrassing in the least and criminal in the most. And what I mean by that is that they asked absolutely stupid questions that were easily answered and completely addressed in the paper. It was as though they never read the papers, they never wanted to accept the paper, and they never really wanted to review the paper. So in Dr. Ketchum's defense, and the rest of the PhDs, they never had a chance with many of these big journals.
Well, I don't want to say I told you so, but I should let the audience know that you were kind enough and Dr. Ketchum to share with me some of the initial results 2.5 years ago. And I was floored by the initial information that had come in, the initial analysis. But I suggested to you at the time that it would be pretty hard to get any journal to publish it, even though the work was done as legitimately as possible.
And you know, that's probably the sobering reminder when you step into a world as a group of amateurs, as we are. We're not from the academic community, which is where most of these papers come from that journals review. And most of the people that sit on the board that review these papers are academic types as well. So maybe it's because we were outsiders, maybe because the findings completely fly in the face of what science may believe is the evolutionary path of a human. I don't know. But it's very disturbing.
Were you surprised by the results? I mean, you said, you know, you had an inkling that it was human. That's what the tribes had said all the way along. But when you finally saw the DNA results, were you floored?
I would say yes, because some of the DNA there isn't answered by going through GenBank. And normally, if we swab our mouse, you and me, we're going to see back thousands of years where we came from and our path. With this DNA, it's highly unusual. And I suppose that part of it was pretty surprising. But in general, you know, when you have dozens and dozens of tribes singing the same song and saying that they've dealt with these beings for hundreds of years, you know, that has to mean something.
You know, there's been a lot of nitpicking in the Bigfoot community about the study, a lot of it nitpicking about Dr. Melba Ketchum herself or things that she said, but I have yet to see any kind of a really solid scientific refutation of the results. I've seen some allegations that it must be contamination, but really there are answers to that, wouldn't you say?
I would think there would be, and as the people in this world know, there's a professor named Brian Sykes from Oxford that took on a study and said he was going to be out with his results around Christmas time. He didn't come out. But now that he has our results, and he probably understands the path that we took to get those results, I would presume that sometime in the next 4 to 6 months, either Sykes will never come out with his study on Bigfoot DNA, or it's going to come out and it's going to mimic what we have.
Well, if it mimics what you have, I mean, that's a heavyweight backing you up.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about, I'll ask one more question on this. Dr. Ketchum, we've had her on the program, and I appreciated her coming on to tell us about the work and to defend it. What's the relationship there now? Is it strained? Because I know you don't see eye to eye on everything, and I don't know if she's... if you are still on speaking terms or whether there's been harm caused to the overall cause by things that have been said, you want to tackle that or not?
Well, I'll say this, that we are the group that went out to find someone to do the study. And we went to three or four different academic institutions explaining that we have the specimens, we have the DNA, we need someone to do the genetics behind it. George, there wasn't one university that wanted to touch the topic. So we had to change path, and we had to find a lab that had the background and the expertise that was willing to take it on. And we weren't funded with a deep well of money. We were lightly funded, so we needed somebody to do this on almost a pro bono basis. And there were a few. Dr. Ketchum's a courtroom-certified expert on genetic studies. She's qualified in the Texas courts many times. And she was one of those people that had an open mind about the topic. And we went with her, and she poured her heart into this, and she succeeded where other people have failed. And I think that some of those people in that genetic world that have made these comments have tried to get to the core of this DNA, and they weren't able to. And I will say that it was Melba's undying attempt to understand the secret behind that genetics that allowed her and her diligence to get to the point of finding it. So I will say I have the utmost respect for her for what she's done. And she has been, and before the study ever came out, we had talks and I explained, hey, this is what's coming. I mean, this, the reason other scientific people don't want to come into this Bigfoot world is it's a world that's filled with hate. I mean, there's so many organizations and there's so many people that call themselves researchers and things that just want to belittle everybody. It's very easy to say something negative about someone, but it's very hard to say something positive. And that comes out in this world, and the attacks are endless. And when a scientific person or an academic person outside looks in, why would they ever want to take part in that? And Melba at least stepped into that world, and she did a stellar job. And for that, I respect her immensely.
Well, I'll tell you, I thought the UFO world was crazy, but it's been an eye-opener for me about the Bigfoot world. I mean, there are obviously some very well-intentioned folks who are curious and open-minded, but it seems like a lot of them are drowned out by people on the fringes who they're more interested in being right or being loud than they are in getting to the truth. I think the most interesting part of the study are the blind tests, is that you and you submit the samples to Dr. Ketchum. She gives them to these high-quality labs and doesn't tell them what they are. And then the labs discover it on their own, and they're kind of floored by the results, and they ask, you know, what the heck is this? And then you have some of them, once they find out what you're up to, oh, you can't use our name. You can't publish these results. Because that is so telling, I think.
It's amazing. You go into this thinking, well, scientists are into discovery. They want to find new things. They want to be challenged. They want to be that person on the paper that finds a new entity in the world. In reality, I think it's just the opposite when it comes to Bigfoot. And again, it goes back to that craziness factor. There's so much disturbance in the community that it almost seems to us as though it's a manipulated process just to make everybody think it is full of craziness.
Tell me this one last question, then we move on. Where does the study go from here? Do you have something else in mind? Additional samples, additional tests?
You know, I've pulled back a lot from that Bigfoot world. Part of our edict as an organization was to prove at a scientific level that the biped exists, and I think we've done it. Whether anyone wants to admit it, whether anyone wants to read the study and take it to that next level, personally, I hope that another academic institution takes a look at this and says, you know what, there is something here. Let's engage. Let's get more specimens in. Let's write it at a different level. Who knows? I do know for a fact that there are two universities out there that are at least looking at it and have people in the field. So that's promising.
That's good. Let's shift gears now. Another reason why you're pulling back from the Bigfoot world is because you've got a heck of a mystery on your hands with the missing 411 volumes. Volume 3 is out, North America and Beyond. It's just as stunning as the first two. I guess to begin with, maybe you can tell me, are a lot of these cases from your radio appearances that people hear you talking about cases in various parts of the country, and then, hey, there was one like that here. Let's send it to Dave.
Oh, absolutely. And I've got to thank the readers and your listeners for opening our eyes to things that we probably could have never found.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's hard to go out and cover entire area of North America on an archival search. So when people call in or write in and say, hey, have you heard of this case? Have you heard of that case? It's great. We appreciate it.
Did you suspect all along that you were going to find cases outside of the U.S.?
We had a hunch at the beginning, but we weren't sure.
Let's start with, we're going to be taking a break here in about 4 minutes or so. Let's start with the basics to recap some of the basics so that those who have not heard you previously understand about the kinds of disappearances we're talking about. First of all, the numbers, a general number that you know of so far. How many?
At least 600, 650 right now.
Most of them in national parks and national forests.
And open spaces in North America.
Tell me about the clusters.
So the first two books, we identified 28 clusters. We're up to, I think, 34 now. And those involved three or more people missing within geographical proximity to each other.
And how many clusters do you have?
I think we're up to 34, 35 right now in North America.
What would be the top one? Yosemite?
Easily.
How many cases there?
There's got to be at least 25.
I remember my first reaction when you told me the general topic, and I thought to myself, well, gosh, yeah, people disappear in the wilderness, in parks, in forests. They get lost. They fall off a cliff. They get eaten by bears. What's so unusual about that? Walk us through some of the steps about the kind of characteristics that separate these cases from just a normal kind of a disappearance.
So any type of disappearance which is related to water, and the water's suspect in the disappearance, meaning a drowning, they got taken downstream, those are not in the study. Any type of suicidal tendency is not in the study. If there's any type of obvious criminal conduct, meaning that the case is classified as a possible homicide, that's not in it. Any type of animal attack is not in the study. And how do we know about animal attacks? Search and rescue people, they're professionals, they know what to look for in these things. They're not in the study. It takes, after reading thousands of missing persons cases, certain elements start to come out at you, and they hit you in the face. Time after time, you read the same thing, and you start to say, how could this be? It's almost like it's a mimic of the other four cases in the same state. And as an example, in Pennsylvania, between like 1930 and 1950, there were more kids missing in that state during that time than anywhere I've ever seen in North America. And it's not even close. And I wrote about that in the Eastern book. So, and the disappearances in those areas almost mimic each other. Many of them involve small children at a farm or in a forest. They disappear. Most times they're never found. A lot of times the people disappear with a canine. Many times if they disappear overnight, bad weather comes into the area, rain, snow, etc. If people are found, many times they're found in a creek bed or riverbed. Other times, if they're found, they're missing clothing or shoes. If they're found, an older person, they can't or they don't want to remember what happened. Other times, it's a disabled person to the point where they can't speak, so they can't communicate what happened. Or it's a very young child and they can't speak at all. Berries, swamps, and boulder fields are three of the predominant things that keep coming up with missing people from the East Coast and the West Coast. And again, it's that clustering aspect. If you went up through the middle of Northern California all the way to the Canadian border, that route of the Cascades has more people missing under unusual circumstances than I can ever tell you, and it has more clusters of missing people up through that area than any place else I can imagine. So those are some of the few.
There are other ones that really jump out at you. The fact that, you know, they are the ones that are found, either bodies or found alive, are found in areas that have been searched repeatedly. In your book, you mentioned one case where the searchers had walked right over that spot 50 times or more and not found them. It's as if they're taken somewhere and then redeposited, or little children who are found miles and miles away, impossible distances, walking uphill. Talk about that for a moment. Well, I tell you what, we're going to take a break here in about 30 seconds, so maybe we save that. How many cases do you mention in the new volume? How many are new?
I think there's about 200 in there.
And what are the talk to me about how many countries you now cover?
Well, we included stories from five countries, predominantly Australia, England, Indonesia, Iceland, and France.
And the Canadian, you knew there were going to be Canadian cases. Did you know there would be this many?
Well, if you look at the topography of North America, you kind of imagine that if there is some type of criminal activity or there's some kind of consistency in disappearance, it's not going to stop at the border. So we kind of presume that it would be happening up north.
When we come back, Dave Politis, I want to get into some of the other characteristics that make these cases less than prosaic, and then we'll get into specifics, case by case, state by state, country by country. Missing 411 with Dave Politis coming up after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Dave Politis back to talk about Volume 3 of his monumental work, Missing 411. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of really interesting cases in this new volume, but one really jumped out at me. It's the story of, we'll call him John Doe, that's the reference in the book, a young child who went missing, then was found alive. And what's most striking about this story is his description to his mother and father about who he encountered during that time when he was missing. It'll chill you to the bone. We'll get into that in just a couple of minutes here on Coast to Coast AM. Dave, I want to spend a few more minutes sort of recapping for those who have heard this before and don't remember it, and for those who haven't heard it, why these cases are so weird. There are a couple of characteristics that really jump out at you. One is about where the kids, particularly kids, how far away they're found. Talk about that.
That's one of the most unusual aspects to this. And when we first got into this, we read just about every search and rescue manual you could find. And when professionals go out into the field, they set up grid patterns to search for people. And it's based upon the topography you're in, based upon the age and the health of the person you're searching for. And for a child, say, under 8 years old, they're usually found within 2 miles 90% of the time, usually within the first 4 to 6 hours. Well, in the Western book that I wrote, I described a kid named David Allen Scott who was 2 years old. And I usually stop at this point when I'm talking to an audience and I say, how many people in the room have children? And I say, think back to when your child was 2 years old. How far could that child walk without dropping from exhaustion? And how fast could they move? How quickly could they get out of your sight? Well, David was with his family vacationing at a place called Mono Village, kind of on the eastern side of the Sierras, down near a city called Bishop. And he disappeared from his family as he was down near a lake. And everyone initially thought he went into the lake. Make a long story short, they searched everywhere. They finally brought in some soldiers. And for some reason, they started going uphill. And they didn't go a little uphill. They went way uphill. And when you look at the valley that David disappeared in, there's a trail that almost goes straight uphill in a zigzag fashion up this mountain. They went over the top of that mountain, down into another valley, back up a partial another mountain, total 3,000 feet, and they found him deceased behind a boulder. They tried to interview the soldier that found him, and they asked him if he had any injuries, and the soldier said no comment. I thought that was interesting. But that one of the stories in the new book involves a boy named Clarence Murphy, and he was vacationing in the Central Sierras in a place called Camp Sacramento, which is at about 6,000 feet. It's a place where families go to take their kids. It's right next to the American River.
Yeah, that's a weird case. That's a spooky one.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And Clarence was vacationing with his mom. He was in a sandbox at the camp, and his mom just stepped away for a couple minutes, and she came back, and he wasn't in the sandbox. And they had a conversation, and he said he would stay there. And they searched. Initially, all the searchers usually go to the river, or they go to the lake, and they search hard there, and that's usually where kids ended up dying and being found. But in the cases here, that's not where they're found. That's not where they go. And Clarence did the same thing that David did. And whether it was against his will or with his will or whatever, he went uphill again. And I can tell you, as an adult, when you're at 6,000 feet and you have a choice between going uphill or downhill, you're going to go downhill because it takes the wind out of you at that elevation. And initially, they searched for 2 weeks. They never found him. And they searched hard. They brought in they pulled out everything they could to find this boy. Well, fast forward from April 14th, 41, 14 months later to September 22nd, 42, there was a deer hunter that was up a ridgeline, 2,000 feet uphill, 2 miles from where Clarence disappeared, and he saw a shoe on the ground, and a little child's shoe, and he knew that somebody had disappeared in that area before. And he went and got a sheriff, and they started searching, and they found little tiny bits of bones, and they didn't find a full skeleton. Coroner made a determination based on a tooth that they found that it was Clarence, and they made a determination that he died of exposure and exhaustion, which is just ridiculous because there's no way they could have known.
No.
But he was in an area that would remind you a lot of Yosemite because there's a place there called Lover's Leap. I've been in this area many times. It's filled with just huge pieces of granite, boulder fields. It's a hell-forsaken place, great place for deer hunting. And this hunter was on his horse, and I think that's probably the only reason he was there, because it's so rugged.
You have cases of where little kids, five or younger, disappear into thin air, and they're found hours later, miles away, right? 8, 9, 10 miles or further in wilderness.
Yes. Yeah, there's a story out of Oregon where a boy disappeared and he was found 12 miles away, 11 hours after he disappeared, over two mountain ranges, over two or three different creeks and rivers, and he had to have gone through fence lines. He was found unconscious the next morning in a creek bed by a search group. But what is more interesting to that case, and there are many others like this, is that why would searchers be in that location? It makes no sense at all. There's no way in the world a search group would be that far from the scene unless they had some other kind of information.
I mean, it's as if these kids, in the case of children, are picked up and transported somehow far away. They couldn't possibly walk that far under their own power.
I don't believe they do. I mean, I have two kids, and everybody I talk to about this says, no, there's no way that could happen. And to your point earlier on about where kids are found, many times they're found on the main trail the searchers are using, and they're found unconscious, sometimes laying on the trail, laying on a boulder next to a trail, but they're in a place that it would be impossible to miss them when you go out that next morning. It's almost like they're put there to view or to find because they weren't there every day that the searchers went out.
Another weird aspect is the inability of dogs to follow a scent. I think that was true in the Clarence case in that Camp Sacramento.
Absolutely. They brought up multiple canines. In fact, in every story in my books, the canines fail to pick up a scent that eventually finds the victim. Sometimes they go a ways down the trail, and then they lay down, and they don't want to search, or there's no more scent. This past summer, I was asked to talk at the largest group of search and rescue professionals in the world in Lake Tahoe. It's called NASSER, National Association of Search and Rescue Professionals. I gave them the 50 cents edition because I only had an hour in front of them, but I gave them the outline of what we're doing and what the canines do. There was a line out the door of these guys wanting to talk about the same things that they'd experienced, but they thought they were just so isolated and unique. And I've been around canines before in the police department when we searched, and these dogs just live for the search. For a search dog to just lay down at that time or not want to track, these searchers that had the canines, they said it's one of two things. Either there's no scent there, or it's extreme fear on the dog's side for some reason that we can't comprehend.
Another aspect that's pretty weird is the people just basically vanish into thin air. You got kids who are out in the yard playing, their parents are 10 or 20 yards away, and boom, they're gone in an instant. Or adults who are hiking with a group, they're the last one on the line, boom, they're gone in an instant. Talk about that for a moment.
Well, there's an interesting case in this new book about that exact incident. And it involves a boy named Jamie Bordenkircher, 2 years old, disappeared June 12, 1965 from the North Shore of Lake Tahoe. And right away, for the people that know that area, this isn't down in the populated area by the lake. His family had a summer home up above Kings Beach on kind of an isolated road, almost to the back of the wilderness, just almost less than a mile from the Nevada border. And Jamie's parents lived in Butte County up in Northern California. They drove down. They parked their car in front of the vacation home. There's no other cabins around, and there's a swing set in front of their house. Well, the family's going in, unloading their things, and Jamie gets out, and his brother says he goes to the swing set, and he gets on the swing. So his brother goes in and is in the house less than 5 minutes, comes back out. The swing is still swinging, and Jamie's gone and nowhere to be seen. And the family got frantic, looked everywhere, found nothing. Huge search that went on for weeks. And for some reason, the canines on this one kept going downhill to the water of the lake. And for the people who don't know this area, it's pretty steep walk downhill. You cross the road that perimeters the lake, and there's a lot of homes down there. And it's a very, very busy highway that crosses that area. So they brought in the Coast Guard. They brought in everybody. They searched everywhere. They didn't find anything. And the interesting aspect to this case is if you go northeast from there, there's a couple of disappearances in an area called Slide Mountain, a ski resort near Incline Village and on the Nevada side. And there's also a disappearance of a girl back in the 1940s from an area that borders Reno and that Slide Mountain area that's in this book. So this is a four-person child cluster area that's evolving just in the last 6 months.
One other weird aspect is what happens to clothes, in particular to shoes.
That is highly, highly unusual, and it's initially something that we were told, well, it could deal with hypothermia, except the issue with this is that it happens so quickly that hypothermia can't be setting in when these kids take their clothes off. In many of the cases, it could be within 200 yards of the point where they were last seen. The clothes are off and they're gone. Sometimes the clothes are found and the shoes are found. Sometimes no clothes and no shoes are found. In many of the cases, the kids are found and they're almost naked, or they're found sitting down in a thicket without any clothes on and without any shoes on. And what we're always wanting to know is what's the condition of their feet. But obviously, in the articles that are older, et cetera, they're not going to have these kind of notations. But if the child walked 2 to 4 miles through the woods without shoes, you know that they're going to have some injuries on their feet. If there's no injuries on their feet, they were carried there.
I know in the previous volumes you had instances where clothes were found folded up or laid out as if in a ritualistic fashion. And I know in the new book you've got a case, I'm trying to remember what it was, but it's an elderly lady who was found wearing different clothes from when she disappeared.
Yeah, that's an interesting case from Central California. A woman disappeared. She's a very wealthy lady. She disappeared from her kind of a rural ranch. And there was a lot of suspicion that the family was involved and a lot of inner griping going on and finger-pointing, et cetera. But they didn't find her for months and months. And then somebody said that they thought this lady picking berries off a berry bush in this remote location near Lake Berryessa. And she was eventually found wearing overalls, like men's overalls, and shoes, and she was found dead. But where she was for the previous 2 months, how she survived, where she got the clothes, there were a million unanswered questions with that case. But in many ways, it mimicked other elements that we see in these cases. So that's why it was included.
I would like you to address for a moment the questions that are buzzing through people's heads. That is, why isn't it a bear or a mountain lion? Why couldn't it be drug smugglers or hermits or mountain men living out there that are abducting people and taking them away somewhere?
And those are the first places everybody goes when they first hear me speak. And I like to say that when we're speaking here on the phone, you're hearing probably less than 1% of the entire story. And so I really don't want anyone to go any place in their mind that can reconcile these thoughts. Because once you read the books, I've yet to find anybody that'll say, hey, this is just bogus. Everyone reads these, and they will see that there's a commonality here of elements in each of the cases. Now, one of the things about animal attacks is that if somebody is attacked, usually you have time to scream. You have time to make noise. And if it's an adult, you're usually going to fight for your life. And that fight is going to result in a huge disturbance on the ground, hair, blood, tissue, etc. There's going to be almost like a major crime scene. And dogs and canines are easily going to pick up that scent and track that down. The reality is that in all of these cases, animal attacks have been excluded. And they haven't been excluded by me. They've been excluded by search and rescue or by the law enforcement agency that's doing the case.
Same thing for people, say drug smugglers out in the national forests. I mean, dogs could follow that scent as well if they were responsible.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, the last thing that somebody who has a meth lab or somebody who's growing weed, the last thing they want to do is do something that's going to bring any law enforcement to the scene. They don't want to cause any disturbance. They don't want to do anything that's going to bring any awareness to what's going on there. Think about that. And if it's an adult and they're going to try to take you, where are you going to go? And it goes back to, well, the canine's going to be able to track you as well. And it's going to be able to track scent. And if you have a meth lab or you have a drug marijuana grow there, the flyovers are going to they're just going to be in the area to such an immense degree, they're going to find it, and it's going to be revealed. The idea that somebody's in the woods abducting people has been brought up in the past. And I don't want to point this at the National Park System because it's an unfair allegation, but I will just say it, is that some people have heard me talk on the radio and say, well, maybe there's a serial killer that's moving around park to park and killing people. The reality is when you read these stories, it's essentially going to be an impossibility based on the facts and the stories.
It's a serial killer who doesn't leave tracks, doesn't leave a scent, has never been caught, leaves no clues.
Exactly. Well said.
In your new book, I mean the new volume, a lot of the law enforcement folks go as far as to say, we don't think this is a normal disappearance. This was a kidnapping of some sort. They don't take it as far as you do because they don't have the database you do, but they think it was a kidnapping just because of the circumstances that you're describing.
Well, even going back to the Bordenkircher case in North Lake Tahoe, it had been 40, 50 years now since Jamie disappeared. In 2007, his mother gave an interview, and in it she said, well, you know, originally I think everyone tried to get me to believe that he drowned in the water. The more I look at it is I believe he was abducted. And when you look at the cases in their totality and you start to read the opinions of law enforcement and adults involved, loved ones, you will see the word abduction in there many, many, many times.
Boy, it has to be frustrating for these lawmen to be out there often with so many resources, with hundreds of people searching to go through an area almost arm in arm and not be able to find something, and then have the body or the missing person appear in an area that they'd walked over 40, 50 or more times.
And I think the public sometimes gets numb to disappearances. Especially children. When a child disappears in the wilderness, the forest, or on a farm or a ranch, the idea that they're not going to be found should not be really in our vocabulary. And when you talk to searchers, they're going to tell you, we're going to stay until we find that kid. And most of the searchers, probably 95, 98% of them, are volunteers. And when I was in Lake Tahoe, that's what it was. There were all these people here voluntarily spending their own money and their own time to get trained, and they have a passion for doing it. And kids that disappear can't go that far. They can't travel that fast. And if you start to think about those two criteria and the number of resources that are at people's disposal, meaning you're going to put helicopters and planes in the air with FLIR, forward-looking infrared radar, to see a heat signature on the ground, well, son of a gun, in all of these cases, FLIR fails. Yet there are so many cases where children disappear and FLIR works.
Dave, when we come, we're going to take a break here. I want to talk more about the use of FLIR, and I want to, when we come back, get into this case of John Doe, because in some cases, kids are found alive, and the stories they tell are pretty chilling. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.